Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, Editor-in-Chief of Total Film Magazine, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. And today I'm joined by one of our contributing editors, Neil Smith. Hi, Neil.
Hello.
Hello. So this week we're reviewing Wes Anderson's latest, Asteroid City, Jennifer Lawrence's sex comedy No Hard Feelings, documentary The Super 8 Years, and Nick Fury's own show Secret Invasion. But before we get on to that, what else have you been watching or doing this week, Neil?
Well, I've been getting ahead on a couple of big summer releases. One of them was Pixar's new animation, Elemental, which at the screening I was at BFI South Bank in London, was followed by a very charming and enjoyable Q&A with the director and two of his voice actors. The film, I think, is as charming as that Q&A was. It's very entertaining. It feels a little bit like Pixar on autopilot, but I'm sure you'll be discussing that on a future podcast. As I'm sure you will be Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny, another big release which critics who didn't go to Cannes had a chance to watch this week. And I left with a lot of nostalgic feels, but an awful lot of rather unnecessary exposition rattling around in my brain.
Yeah, you sat behind me, didn't kick my seat, thank for that. Yes, I saw Indiana Jones this week too, because I did not go to Cannes. And I was disappointed. And also, I have so many questions.
The things that work well, like Phoebe Waller-Bridge and other cast members, possibly, are enjoyable. But there seems to be a sort of tiredness and lethargy built into it, possibly as a result of Harrison Ford's sort of, you know, advancing years, the fact he can't be quite as active and quite as animated as he has been in the past for all the CGI that they use. But yeah, there's just sort of, you know, I was really, really hankering for the zest and the energy of the original Indiana Jones trilogy, which I think is in pretty short supply here.
Yeah, it's just basically Indiana Jones does Bill and Ted. I'll say no more, but that's essentially what it boils down to. And it's dumb in not a good way. I saw three films that day. I started with Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1, which I cannot talk about. But let's just say of that day, one of those films was far above the others. So, Indy, we'll discuss it at length on a future podcast and possibly in a special because there's so much to unpack. But yeah, it was a crystal skull for me. Oh, such a shame. I also, yesterday, was on a film set of a very highly anticipated film that gave me goosebumps to be on set of and to be in some of the sets, handling some of the props and seeing a performance that I just think will tickle people so much. I am obviously embargoed up the wazoo with an NDA, but it was very, very good. And I can't wait to talk about that more. In the meantime, shall we get on to what we can talk about? No NDAs, no embargoes. We can talk about all this lot. Let's get quirky with this.
You're not here.
We're not there. The car exploded. Come get the girls. I have to stay here with Woodrow.
I'm not the chauffeur. I'm the grandfather. Where are you?
Asteroid City, Farm Route 6, mile 75.
Last train. Junior stargazers and space cadets. Each year we celebrate Asteroid Day. Commemorating September 23rd, 3007 BC, when the Arid Plains meteorite made Earth impact.
So this is Wes Anderson's Asteroid City. Do you want to set it up for us? I mean, it's obviously a lot of quirkiness and cuteness and like very specific palettes and miniatures and everything else that we might expect from Wes Anderson.
Well, let's set up by the year is 1955, and in the American Southwest, there's a place called Asteroid City. It's very small little town with a luncheonette, a filling station, a motor court hotel, and a telephone booth. Not much else apart from a gigantic crater, which was caused by an asteroid hitting it many millennia ago, back 3007 BC, to be perfectly correct about it.
Let's be precise. Yes.
And a whole bunch of young kids are descending on Asteroid City for a junior stargazing convention and show off their inventions and their scientific experiments. And it feels a bit like sort of Rushmore in the desert. So that's the basic setup. What is going on at the same time is that what we're actually watching, we discover, is a play that's being put on the Broadway stage again in the 1950s in a black and white New York City, and which is being recorded for a television documentary hosted by Bryan Cranston as this very stiff and formal TV presenter. So effectively, you've got a dual narrative happening on sort of either side of America in the 1950s, and you've got the actors in one side, Jason Schwartzman and Scarlett Johansson, as actors who are playing the characters in the color action Asteroid City drama that's unfolding in the desert. Now, if you can get your head around that, then you get the story itself, which, as well as having a junior stargazing convention and various other sort of entanglements involving all the different characters, features, I don't think it's too much of a spoiler, an unexpected arrival that throws all of that into a different kind of perspective and sort of generates a second act in which other things happen. So quite a lot going on, a very large amount of characters, all of them played by someone you'll recognize.
Yeah.
It's one of the starrest ensembles that Wes Anderson's put together, all in the service of a slightly philosophical musing on our place in the universe and where we go to when we die.
Wow. Okay. Well done, Neil. I could not have done that. You did that very well. Big question, though. Did you like it?
Wes Anderson has become a genre, right. A very imitable genre. In fact, there's all these TikTok copies or parodies of his work, which you can even get kind of AI to generate for you.
He doesn't like that, though, does he? He's not impressed with that.
I'm sure he doesn't, because there is such a kind of meticulous vision at work in his pieces. Everything is so formal and beautifully kind of assembled, right down from the largest set to the smallest piece of smallest trinket on the set. And the actors, in a way, are puppets. There are actual puppets in this movie, but the actors are marionettes in a way, because they're hitting their marks and they're delivering his very, well-crafted dialogue. It's a sort of a specific speed that he wants it delivered at. So you've got actors very well known. You've got Scarlett Johansson, you've got Jason Schwartzman, Tom Hanks filling in, one would assume, for Bill Murray, who isn't part of this particular ensemble. And they're all interacting in what does feel, probably appropriately, a rather theatrical piece of dialogues that all go together towards a slightly sort of philosophical meditation on rather sort of almost spiritual themes. It's so great to look at. Every scene is beautiful, every set is great. But even when I was looking at it, I was thinking, I think I'm going to enjoy the exhibition in which I can look at all these props and sets and costumes close up more than I'm actually enjoying the film itself. And there is an exhibition. If you happen to live in or around London, it's running till early July at the 180 Studios, and it's in the Aldwych area of London, and it's all fabulous kind of collection of all the sets and costumes and little kind of trinkets and pieces of set decoration that you only get.
You can sit at the diner, can't you? You can sit at the diner and have a little milkshake like Scarlett.
And you can kind of analyze and pick up all the details that Wes has spent so much time crafting into your heart's content. In the film itself, they go by in a flash, and the film is so intent on giving every one of this starry ensemble at least a little something to do. It doesn't hang together particularly cohesively. You have people popping up for a short number of scenes. Edward Norton, Adrian Brody, Jeff Goldblum in a slight comedy cameo, and other people less familiar like Margot Robbie and Bryan Cranston, as I mentioned earlier. So you feel as if he's got all these people in this movie. He's got to give them something to do. But the result is that all of them don't have very much to do. And they're all little pieces of this rather intricate jigsaw puzzle that, when you actually see the whole picture, isn't that terribly impressive.
Agreed. I do like Wes Anderson, and I love, Grand Budapest Hotel. I love The Fantastic Mr. Fox, but it's starting to wear off on me. I feel like it's very samey, and to the point that it's almost a pastiche of what he does. I don't think you need to go to TikTok, because it's right here. This is is Wes Anderson doing Wes Anderson to the nth degree? And it's actually got tiresome to me. And that sort of bittiness that you talk about, I found very unsatisfying, frustrating, actually. and then ultimately boring. And I struggled to actually care about anyone because he didn't give me enough to care about with anyone. And it's all so arching in this dialogue where everyone talks at a certain speed and everyone has to talk very, very quickly about everything without any kind of emotion. I found it very difficult to fall in love with anybody in this. So it felt very cold to me, very beautiful, gorgeous. Love the Roadrunner that pops up. I love the music. I love the artistry of it, but it leaves me unmoved.
Which is peculiar because there is a personal story in there. Jason Schwartzman has taken his three kids into the desert to attend the Stargaze convention, and their mother has recently died, and he hasn't got around to telling them that their mother is dead and that he's carrying her ashes in this Tupperware container. And Tom Hanks, as his father-in-law, is on his case saying, "You really have to tell these kids this." So you think, oh, well, maybe there might be something kind of personal and moving in this. But even that is dealt with in that very kind of arch and slightly cold and stylized way that is such a part of the Wes Anderson milieu, if you like.
Yeah.
At the points when he's trying to be emotional, he's trying to be intimate or personal, even they feel like you're watching puppets or marionettes or he's been so successful in the field of animation, maybe he should stay in animation. I think the movies like Fantastic Mrs. Fox and Isle of Dogs seem to fit his way of filmmaking better than live action, because particularly when you get actors that aren't necessarily suited to it. And I felt Tom Hanks looked visibly uncomfortable in this particular movie because he wasn't given any room to be Tom Hanks or be likable.
There was none of the Tom Hanks warmth, which I would have thought is why you cast him. And also, you know, there was potential for that role to be warm as the grandfather coming into this family that's had this terrible tragedy and trying to be a salve for it, but being so like chippy and fast talking and not really emotionally involved. And also, again, the era doesn't allow for that either. This is the 50s, as you said, so there's none of that sort of happy, clappy, smiley warmth that, you know, people are just, you know, very interested in being very proper. So that doesn't help either. The only thing I liked about it really was that it reminded me of going on holiday to Arizona when I did go to Meteor Crater National Park, which is a giant meteor crater in the middle of the desert. And you do go and drive up and there is a diner and you park your car and you pay your ticket. You go to the edge, you look in the hole and you go, that's a big hole. And that is it. And you've driven 50 miles out of your way to look at that. But there we are. That's more about me than really about Wes Anderson. So if you're a Wes Anderson fan, Neil, is this just like lovely, like a vat of Anderson to swim in? Or is this something that might actually try Anderson fans as well?
I think if you're a Wes Anderson fan, you're going to follow him to the ends of the earth, or indeed to the ends of the desert. I think that this movie is going to be so full of the things that we love about Wes that you're going to lap up every quirky moment of it. But this, if you've been following his career, you're starting to feel as if he's running on empty a little bit, and that the way he makes his movies are no longer surprising or as emotionally rewarding as they once were.
You've just described me, so that's what I would say. Yes. Worth a ticket to the cinema this weekend? I mean, it's worth seeing on a big screen rather than waiting for it to go to streaming, right?
I would say, because it's such a beautiful film to look at, and it's such a beautiful film to listen to, and there's so many delightful little moments that you really need to appreciate on a big screen. Although, again, if you're a Wes fan, you'll be going back to it when it's on the small screen, kind of freeze framing every delicious moment of it. So yes, I think it is a big screen experience, will be enjoyed on the big screen, but possibly not as much as the films that would want to make you see this one in the first place.
I don't think I would have actually wanted to spend my money, actually. I'm sorry to say, Wes. I think I need to go back to Fantastic Mr. Fox and just enjoy that again. But if you fancy Wes Anderson and Asteroid City, it is out in cinemas on Friday. Right, we move on to something that isn't, very staid. It's getting flirty now with this.
Hi. Mind if I touch your wiener?
What?
Your dog.
His parents hired me to bring him out of his shell before college.
You've just been so worried about our son.
Hi.
Am I allowed to be here?
We can go skinny dipping.
What about sharks?
Men here.
It's really the lack of lifeguard.
We're sitting here right now. One thing
about me, I'm the dance party.
How's the kid working out?
This is going to be harder than I thought.
You can't know about this.
Percy!
Natalie!
This is your babysitter, right?
No.
So this is No Hard Feelings. Jennifer Lawrence as a bawdy girl from Montauk who takes up the challenge of a newspaper ad, which is to date a 19-year-old sheltered boy in exchange for a secondhand Buick. Neil, want to expand on that a little bit?
This feels like Jennifer Lawrence's mainstream return. We had her kind of art house Oscar bait return last year in Apple TV film Causeway, which was sort of like her return to, if you like, awards worthy filmmaking, whereas this is pretty much her return to the multiplex in what feels like a comedy that maybe Amy Schumer, who I know she's good friends with, might have been involved with some point. It's pretty much in that vein, the vein being a kind of raunchy, bawdy sex comedy that back in the day you would associate with the likes of Porky's and American Pie, I think. And the very center of it is, I think, a pretty hard to sell premise. The idea that this 32-year-old, rather sort of rootless young woman from Long Island, in order to get the new car she needs to continue her job as an Uber driver and get the money she needs to save her late mother's house from being repossessed, takes a wealthy couple up on their offer to give their sheltered young son effectively a sex education.
Yeah, The Graduate, but with rollerblades.
Yes, pretty
That's
much.
That's the aim, possibly, but not necessarily the outcome.
It was a tough hurdle to get over, this idea that however you want to frame it, and they do try to frame it in a sort of sugar-coated way as possible by bringing in the late mother and the house and the fact that she only wants to get a car so she can earn her money with as an Uber driver. She's accepting payment for sexual favors.
Yeah, but so was Pretty Woman, Neil, and no one has a problem with that.
True. No one has a problem with that. And the age difference, you know, the boy is 19 and she's 32. There's nothing wrong with the age difference as well. You work perfectly well in The Graduate. Where I think this movie has a problem is the element of deception involved. The young kid, who's played by a young actor who's very charming, is being persuaded that Jennifer Lawrence really has the hots for him and wants to begin a relationship at a rather impressionable time in his life, whereas she is really doing it just for her own ends and under false pretenses. So that's where I think you're entering into a bit of a moral quagmire. The fact that they're toying with this young boy's affections, and the parents are doing it because they want the kid to be sort of, you know, to go to Princeton and not be, I don't know, excluded or bullied, to basically be on a par with his future Princeton classmates. Which is, again, a rather specious argument. It's like, you know, they're doing it, but they're not telling him they're doing it. So I'm putting myself a bit in the young man's shoes. How is this young man going to feel when he realizes that this relationship that he believes is genuine turns out to be a sham, cooked up by the people that he should be able to trust the most, his parents? That's where I think the movie has a problem. The word I used in my review was grubby, and I think it is a bit grubby.
There's a number of issues, if you actually think about this logically, which I think the filmmakers don't want you to do. That's not the aim. There's no logic really involved in this. But if you think about it, saying that you are not a complete adult unless you drink, drive, screw, do crazy things and have a disregard for other people is a very strange message, isn't it? Why can't you go to Princeton and not be all those things and have a good time? Surely you can. And also, why should you be pressured into doing any of those things until you arrive at a place where you would like to have a drink, or you would like to drive a car, or you would like to have sex with someone? And the other thing I kept thinking was, if you gender flip this, this would be really dark. Like, if you had a parent hiring an older gigolo man to basically try to force a young girl to lose her virginity, that would be really, really problematic. But because we have this history in cinema of the you know, The Graduate and things like that. It doesn't seem to be a problem, and it's played for laughs. But then they try to put this socioeconomic line through it, where there's the push-pull between the rich people coming into Long Island and taking all the land, and the locals not being able to afford it, a bit like Cornwall and various other places in the UK. And that seems also kind of at odds with this. And then you've got Jennifer Lawrence going full-on frontal nudity for a scene where she kicks the shit out of two people or three people that steal her clothes on a beach, and she comes raring out, and it's played for laughs. And again, I don't know why this is happening or why this was necessary. It feels like the weird sex pressure thing is difficult for me. Had it just been, could you date our son and befriend him and help him out of his shell by perhaps offering him new experiences that he's complicit in, that might have felt a bit better. But because it's the raunchiness and she's constantly trying to jump on him and get him to have sex, which she feels is completely transactional and not bothered about. You know, they have a whole conversation where it's like, I had sex because I couldn't be bothered for the commute home. I had sex because, I thought the person might kill me. And that's played for a laugh, which is also problematic. So, yeah, if you apply any kind of actual logic to this, it doesn't work. But if you want to see Jennifer Lawrence leaning into her persona that she actually is, like if you ever interview her, she's very sort of jokey and funny. Is this a way of seeing the real Jennifer?
I really felt that, like the character that she's playing, Jennifer Lawrence is a really talented and personable actress who could bring the talent and the charisma that she has to any project. And I'm just disappointed that this is the one that she brought it to. I don't think it's worthy of her. I think it really rather cheapens her. And it doesn't do her or the director, Gene Stupnitsky, who had a success a few years ago with a far more charming comedy called Good Boys.
Yeah.
I don't think it does them any favors. The only one I think who emerges with any credit is Andrew Barth Feldman, who plays the young 19-year-old Percy, who, entirely against what his parents say of him, turns out to be a very charming and likable and genial person with a great deal of hidden talents, quite like the actor himself, who at one point does a solo piano performance of the Dale Hall and John Oates hit Maneater, which he does as a sort of like, you know, ballad, which I think really works because it's the idea is that it, you know, sort of awakens Jennifer Lawrence to this sort of, you know, diamond in the rough that she's been kind of given custody of, if you like, or that she's been asked to look after and bring out of its shell. I thought that the actor really looked like Linguini from Ratatouille. And then I realized he did actually play Linguini in Ratatouille in the sort of unofficial musical version that went viral during lockdown. And he's a Broadway actor who was in Dear Evan Hansen. So he is, again, well, like Jennifer Lawrence, much better than material, but he alone manages it to elevate it somewhat.
Yeah. I sort of wondered if, because she's had an Oscar, that maybe she's not getting the wider gamut of offers that she'd like to. And this is like some sort of weird career strategy to show producers that she is capable of, you know, big budget, big broad projects, not necessarily just Oscar bait, and that maybe she wants to go down a route of, I don't know, being a Bond girl or whatever it is that she fancies doing. And this is her calling card to say, look, don't just give me the Oscar stuff. I don't know. I'd love to know what her decision-making process was. I don't think it's absolutely abysmal. I think you'll get some fun out of watching this. There's some quite good lines, there's some silly moments. And as you say, the two actors do manage to bring this real warmth to it when in the final third that is far better than the material. And I guess if you just want a really mindless night out on a Saturday with boobs and cars and goodness knows what else is going on, a lot of rollerblading, then it might work for you as just a mindless thing. But if you do start to think about it too much, you have questions like, surely there's other jobs she could have got.
This could have been in development for a number of years and it may have had various other people's attached. But arriving at this particular point in, if you like, sort of like, you know, the global conversation where we're having discussions about coercive relationships and toxic relationships and abuses of power between people of different ages in the media and in politics and in our national life. It just feels like a tone-deaf movie to come out in this particular climate. And I think it's a movie that's, I don't really feel you can divorce yourself from those questions. I think that it's very scenario invites those questions. And I don't think they're easy questions. And I don't think this movie is particularly interested in providing any answers either.
Maybe it would have been better had he decided, the boy decided, Percy, that he wanted to come out of his shell. And he thought he would put the ad in the paper and he would drive it. But actually, within that process, he learned that he didn't want to and he didn't need to. And she learned something from him. Maybe that would have sat better if he had actually driven that. But yeah, as you say, the fact that he is this very, very nice boy who is basically being played by his parents and this girl is quite problematic. Okay, well, we invite you to go and see it and tell us what you think of No Hard Feelings. Is it funny or is it a bit weird? It's out in cinemas on Friday. Right, it's time to go back to home videos. You know those ones where your dad films you for ages whilst you're looking at a birthday cake and you just freeze in the lens and it's the most boring VHS you've ever seen? It's this.
Ce qui me frappe dans les toutes premières images qui ont été tournées, c'est le caractère de happening théâtral auquel l'arrivée de la caméra dans la famille a donné lieu. Un happening imaginé par mon mari, qui a saisi le moment où je revenais avec les enfants de l'école et des courses au supermarché.
So this is the Super 8 years. Neil, it is about Super 8, but what else?
Well, the French writer Annie Ernaux is a bit of a legend in our own country. She won the Nobel Prize for Literature not so long ago. And the way that we may know her is because some of her autobiographical fictions have been turned into film, most recently in the Happening film that was about a young woman being sort of forced into getting rid of a child through means which at the time were illegal and criminalized. This is even more autobiographical in the fact it's an hour-long documentary in which Annie Ernaux, with the help of her son, goes back to the Super 8 films that her ex-husband filmed between 1972 and 1981. And what she does is she kind of pieces them together. She looks at all the various trips they took, the family celebrations they celebrated, and she looks at them with the eyes that she has now. And she sees things that she wasn't able to see or maybe even willing to see back then. So it's a sort of meditation on the past, on the way that people change and the way that things that we seek to capture tell us more than we knew at the time about the relationships and about what was going on and how a tiny frame of a film shot 40 years ago can tell you so much about what happened or what was going on when the cameras weren't rolling.
It has this quite ponderous like voiceover from her that's very writerly, very sort of, you can see the words on the page and that's what she is famed for. And then these very silent Super 8 films that are very much like we all have of our youth. It's an hour long. I don't really feel like it's worth seeing. Do you?
Well, it is an hour long, and I believe the distributor Curzon are going to add a Q&A afterwards to kind of get it up to like 90-minute length in the actual cinema. Though it is only an hour long, it does feel quite long, longer than that. And it does go all around the world. I mean, they take trips to Chile and they take trips to Albania and they take a trip to Corsica and Moscow. So it's in terms of like a snapshot of the world at that time, it's quite interesting. I particularly love the scenes where they go to London. They go and see tourist spots and the London Pavilion in Piccadilly Circus. Confessions of a Driving Instructor is the box office hit of that day. So if you have an interest in possibly, you know, kind of excavating or looking over the past, this is a way to do it. But then again, we've all got past which we can excavate if we choose to. What makes this particular woman's experiences any more illuminating or enlightening than anyone else's is possibly a moot point.
Yes, I agree. I found it as boring as watching any of the VHSs that we've got at home of our Christmases, where it's like, God, nothing happens because it's just real life. And I felt this was really self-indulgent. I think it's a beautiful film for her to share with her family. And, you know, maybe if you're a fan of her writing, you'll really enjoy that narration that she does. But I just don't know why it's interesting to anyone that isn't related to those people in those films, because I don't feel that she does shed any universal or wider light on anything that's going on in them. And although she does talk about her own feelings and, you know, the struggle to become a writer while sort of trapped in this role as a housewife and a mother, it really didn't feel like it went far enough to actually explore that as a wider experience. So for me, this is just a curiosity that will have a limited appeal.
If you are familiar with the author and you've read some of her work or maybe seen some of the other films based on it, this makes a kind of interesting, possibly appendix or sort of footnote to those other movies that you might have enjoyed or books that you might have read. On its own merits, if you come to it cold, you really will wonder, well, why is this being given a cinema exhibition? It's the kind of film that you might almost be more at home in a gallery as an installation.
Yeah, yeah. It's sort of like that David Hockney installation that was in London, that sort of him musing about his art and the voiceover. And yeah, it very much feels like that. I think that would have been a better use for it.
It did remind me, though, we used to have a Super 8 camera. We had a Tom and Jerry cartoon. And one of the, when we were growing up, one of the funniest things we used to do was play it backwards. And it became 10 times funnier when we did that. So it brought back the nostalgia that I have for the form.
Yes.
But what was I was actually seeing on film wasn't as gripping. And maybe the fact that it was taking me into my own experience is a sign that maybe the film itself wasn't that captivating.
Yeah. But would you actually put your film of you going backwards out as a theatrical item?
Oh, goodness. That'd be X-rated. No, I don't think I would, actually. I don't think I would have the confidence to think that my personal experience would have a wider sort of interest beyond my nearest and dearest. And I suppose it shows something about a writer, the way a writer kind of draws on their own life, that Annie Arnaud and her son might think that there is a film in this because they can see things in it that that possibly we can't.
Okay. Well, I wouldn't say that this is worthy of your time either, but if you fancy seeing the Super 8 years, it is out in cinemas on Friday. It's now time for a little bit of old Nick. It's this.
This is personal.
Very few of us know about the wars fought in the shadows that have raged on this planet. Do you feel responsible?
Where are the Avengers?
This war is one I have to fight. Alone.
So this is Secret Invasion, Marvel's latest. Nick Fury gets his own series. Where do we find Nick? What's going on?
Secret Invasion is, I suppose you would kind of describe it as a TV follow-up to the Captain Marvel movie that Samuel L. Jackson made with Brie Larson, in which introduced the Skrulls as this race of alien shapeshifters who have the ability to take on the form of anybody or anything. And that movie was set back in the 40s or 50s, possibly the 60s, had a de-aged Samuel Jackson, and as well as introducing the Skrulls, introduced the Captain Marvel character played by Brie Larson, who doesn't appear here, because this is a sort of what has happened to the Skrulls in the present day. Nick Fury, we learn, who has this friendly relationship with the Skrulls and their leader, Talos, played by Ben Mendelsohn, has kind of agreed if they'll help him, he'll help them find a new world. a world which they can settle on, having been banished from their homeland. But he hasn't really made good on the promise, and the Skrulls are getting a bit impatient. And now there's two factions of Skrulls, the sort of the benign Skrulls who want to work with humankind, and the sort of more kind of ambitious or nefarious Skrulls that have decided that that if Earth won't provide them a home, they'll make Earth their home. And all this because Nick Fury, for reasons I quite remember, has been sort of orbiting the Earth on a space station. It draws him back to Earth to stop this the evil Skrulls putting their world-threatening plans in action. So I think that's where Secret Invasion starts. I mean, you know, the clue is in the title, really.
It's an invasion that's secret.
And because the Skrulls can take it on any form, it means that you can't trust anybody, and people who you may think you can trust, you can't. And people who take on one form may have an entirely different one. What it really is, if you look at the MCU as a kind of spectrum between the sort of the Earthbound and the far off fantastical, this is more of the Earthbound. It's an espionage thriller. Closest correlative is probably the Falcon and the Winter Soldier. That's a vein of MCU dramas that sort of draw on the 70s and conspiracy thrillers like, you know, All the President's Men, Parallax View, and so on. Without giving too much away, because we've only had a chance to watch the first two episodes, it's really about how Nick Fury can draw on the help of the good Skrulls to defeat the bad Skrulls and the various allies and foes he makes along the way. The good thing about it is the newcomers. Olivia Colman plays a character called Sonia Fallsworth, who I was not familiar with, as in not having the sort of background in the comics as other people may have. So she made a very appealing and charismatic entrance as someone involving British intelligence who uses very un-Olivia Colman-like methods to reach her ends and to get the information that she needs from the Skrulls. And there are various characters we know before. There's Maria Hill, played by Kobe Smulders. There's Agent Ross, played by Martin Freeman. And there is Don Cheadle returning as Rhodey Rhodes. But obviously, it's really a vehicle for Samuel L. Jackson appearing with woolly hat, but without eye patch.
Yes.
As a sort of older, grumpier, almost like a Indiana Jones style Nick Fury returning to Earth to find it much changed and to find that maybe the role he once played in world affairs isn't as there for him as it once was.
If you're like a big Marvel fan, is this essential viewing? Can you skip this? What would you say?
I never felt that the Captain Marvel strand, the Skrull strand, was particularly well-developed, and we've only had one Captain Marvel movie to date. And no sooner was she introduced, she was pretty much subsumed within the whole Avengers Endgame drama. So if you want to find out more about that particular strand and the Skrulls, there is that. I feel that compared with some of the adversaries that the Marvel superheroes have faced, the Skrulls are pretty ordinary. I mean, they can really just change their faces and they can just, you know, go from one to another, which is fine as far as it goes, but only has a limited applicability in the world that they're seeking to overcome. There's some decent action, particularly in the first episode. There's a impressive set piece which purports to take place in Moscow, but it was actually filmed in Halifax. In fact, most of this series was
Halifax.
Shot in the
Halifax, the homeland.
Based on the two episodes I've seen, I don't feel it's as essential as a part of the MCU world building as others we've seen. It feels a little bit Earthbound. There's a lot of talk in it. There's more talk than action, and they seem to be passing out the effects quite parsimoniously. In terms, they don't want to blow all their effects budget in the first episode, to the point that even when they're changing faces now, they do it off camera, which I think is a bit of a cheat. You just hear a sound that you associate with a Skrull turning into something else rather than actually doing the transformation on camera, as it were. But I'm intrigued. I don't think I'm necessarily as gripped as I have been by some of the by WandaVision, for example, or by the first season of Loki, which I thought was always sort of up in the ante. This seems to be a pretty straightforward, limited narrative, but I'm intrigued to see where it goes, and I'm also intrigued to see how, or indeed if, it's going to be incorporated in future big screen iterations.
Yeah. I mean, they're dropping these once a week, aren't they? You're not getting them in one go. So you do have to wait and see. But I kind of feel like I've got that FOMO with this. I fear that if I don't watch it, then we're going to get to the end of it and it's going to be intersecting something that is of major importance into the Marvels that's coming up, or Loki season 2, or something that I'm going to need to know. So I'm probably going to watch it, not necessarily because this really thrills me. Actually, the Skrulls do not thrill me, but I will probably watch it purely to ensure I miss nothing.
And after all these MCU films in which Nick Fury kind of pops up at the end or makes a kind of brief cameo, is on the phone, it's good to see him driving the story and to take full advantage, finally, of Samuel L. Jackson's persona and charisma and his ability to hold the camera. And I think the fact that he's not using an eye patch helps in that, because you can see, you know, his eyes, or at least one good eye, and you feel as if he's giving more to this particular project than he might have given to some of his sort of, like, you know, phoned-in cameos he's given over the years. I don't know if this is intended to be Nick Fury's final hurrah or his kind of, like, you know, grace note, but it's good to see him finally at the center of the story and drive the narrative, and Samuel L. Jackson giving something meaty to do with other actors of his caliber.
It's not as snarky here. This is much more dramatic for Samuel L. Jackson, isn't it, than we've seen in the sort of snapshots we see of him when he pops in and out of other Marvel films. That's edifying. You know, I love Samuel L. Jackson as an actor. I would like to see him do more. So yeah, you sold it to me, Neil. I will watch it. And if you fancy watching The Secret Invasion, it is on Disney Plus now. That is it for this week. We should talk about our new issue, shouldn't we, Neil, which is out today. And it's got Heart of Stone on the cover, which is Gal Gadot and Jamie Dornan's new action movie. It's her sort of bid for a female Bond. That float your boat, Neil?
It does. After the slightly blink and you'll miss her cameos that she made in some of the films, I'm looking forward to seeing Gal Gadot take on a leading role. And I hope that it's a vehicle worthy of her particular talents and the star power that she can bring to a project.
Yeah, because she has just popped up quite literally in Fast X and in The Flash and in something else. What else was she in? She was in 3, wasn't she? She turned up in 3 Shazam. Things. Shazam. Yes, I've forgotten pretty much everything about Shazam, but there we are. So if you do fancy reading more about that, plus Mission Impossible and Ahsoka and a load of action movies, that is on sale now. Neil, what was your film of the week? Quite a mixed bag this week. What was the one that you'd be sending people out to the cinemas?
I think I will go back to Asteroid City. I think that it is a film that should be seen on the big screen. And even if it's not peak Wes, it is still good Wes.
Okay, I found that tiresome and irritating beyond belief. So I'm actually going to go for No Hard Feelings, which I know is counter to what we've said. But I do think Jennifer Lawrence is such a charismatic performer, and her physical comedy in this is very funny. There's a scene where she tries to be seductive on a couch in an office, which I really did enjoy. So I would say go and see that and remind yourself that she is a really great actress, and let's hope that she chooses the next one in a better vein. A reminder then, if you like this podcast, you can make your life easier by subscribing, and we will be back next week with more. But before we do go, here is a question from a reader. Are you ready, Neil? What is the greatest stunt in cinema?
As someone who grew up watching Bond movies, I still think you can't beat the ski jump at the beginning of The Spy Who Loved Me. The fact that it was done for real, the fact that it was it required so much planning, and the fact they had one tiny little window to get it, and in fact they only managed to capture it on one camera, and the fact that the stuntman, Rick Sylvester, you know, risked life and limb and almost died because there's something that went wrong during the stunt. It just makes it, every time I see it, it's a heart in mouth moment. The thing that comes closest to it is another Bond stunt, I think. It's a bungee jump from GoldenEye. When you see the great stunts in cinema, I think there's the Bond movies and there's kind of everything else.
I agree. I think one of my favourite stunts is also in a Bond movie, which is that spiral car jump in The Man with the Golden Gun, where they rev up a car up a bridge that's sort of broken in half and the car does a spin and lands on the other side of the bridge. Again, one of those things where you're like, that's done for real. And they've really had to get that car up that ramp at the correct speed and flip it and get it back down the other side. I love that one. But also, you know, I love the cliffhanger stunt when they rappel out the back of one plane and into another one in order to take it hostage, which was also done for real, which just blows my mind, the idea of like jumping out of one plane and throwing yourself into one that's behind it over a mountain range. That's amazing. And obviously, we can't not talk about Mission Impossible stunts. Tom Cruise clinging to the side of a plane. Bananas. And there'll be more of that, where that came from, with Dead Reckoning Part 1, as we've seen with the motorcycle jump, which actually I think owes a lot to that stunt you're talking about in The Spy Who Loved Me. You know, that idea of flying off the edge of a cliff and having to get your parachute open, which is what Cruise does in this film. Yeah, so without Mr. Bond, we probably wouldn't have all the Mission Impossible things. And without Bond and that filmmaking team inventing those stunts as they went along and providing the groundwork, perhaps we wouldn't be seeing the things that Tom Cruise is doing. If you want to see a countdown of stunts, little segue, there is one in the current issue. So do go and find that. Find out which is our number one. It could be one of the ones we've talked about. Anyway, that's all we have time for. It's time for us to go and kick ass and get into action, Neil, elsewhere off this podcast. So for now, let's say goodbye. Say goodbye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.